Hello and welcome to the Money Talk podcast. I'm Ed Monk. Today on the show, we're jargon busting with an explanation of liquidity risk and why it can be an issue for investors of all levels, even if you're the country's most famous fund manager. If you enjoy the show, please rate us, share us, or leave a comment wherever you get your podcasts. Liquidity is a horrible piece of financial jargon, but understanding it and the danger of not having enough of it can make all the difference to your investing. Liquidity risk can affect the biggest companies and the most famous investors, as we will discuss, but also individuals in their own financial lives. So we thought it would be worth discussing, and to help do that, I'm joined by Tom Stevenson, Investment Director here at Fidelity. Tom, like I said there, the term liquidity is jargon you hear all the time in relation to financial matters without much further explanation. So before we get into some real-world examples of it, how would you define the term liquidity?
Yeah, good question, Ed. And liquidity does have a precise meaning in a financial context. And basically it means it refers to the ability to convert an asset into cash, and specifically to do that without moving the price away from its fundamental value. So, cash itself is obviously 100% liquid because it's already in cash. But some other assets are pretty liquid. So, large capitalization shares on a big stock exchange like the London Exchange or the New York Exchange, those are very liquid because you can easily find a buyer for those assets. Other assets, much less liquid. So, for example, a big commercial property or indeed something like a bottle of fine wine or a classic car, something like that. They're all assets that have a value, but you might not get the right price for them immediately. You might have to wait for a suitable buyer to come along to get the right price.
So it's a sort of expression of how easy it is to buy and sell things without time delays, costs, things like that.
Yes, not getting the right price or not being able to do it now. Those are probably the two key factors.
Okay, and well, I guess the reason we're talking about it and the reason it can be particularly dangerous is that it can appear as a sort of hidden risk, if you see what I mean, or a hidden a destroyer of value. I read a description of liquidity this week, which said that you hardly ever need liquidity, and then you really do need it quite a lot. It seems to, when liquidity risk goes wrong, it can feel like that.
Absolutely. I mean, if you absolutely need the money now, then you will know very clearly whether you're in a liquid or an illiquid asset, because you will or will not be able to sell it at the right price and at the right time. It's a reason to be cautious with your investments and to plan for the worst case scenario, because as you say, the worst case scenario might be very unlikely to happen, but if it does happen, you don't want to be caught out by it.
Yes, and I guess the reason we're talking about it this week is because Neil Woodford, probably the best known UK fund manager, has been having his own issues with liquidity. Now, this relates to investments that he's made within his funds and his investment trusts in small companies, sometimes unquoted companies. What's been going on, and how does that relate to liquidity?
Well, the problem which Neil Woodford has faced is actually to do with the flows in and out of his funds. Because, yes, he does hold a number of relatively illiquid assets within his funds. When his fund was stable, when there was lots of money in there and money was not coming out, that was not an issue. No one was really bothered by the fact that some of the assets held within the fund could not be bought and sold readily. What's happened is that money has flowed out of the fund, and that has changed the proportion of the fund which is held in these illiquid assets. And the reason why that's a problem is that there are rules which govern how much of a fund can be held within illiquid assets, basically 10%. You can't hold more than 10% of a fund in unquoted assets. As the value of the overall fund has fallen, the proportion held in those unquoted assets has risen above 10%. And that has meant that Neil Woodford has suffered from the problem that we've just been talking about. He needs to reduce the holdings of the unquoted assets. Because they're illiquid assets, he's struggling to do that at the right price.
Yeah, and so to flesh that out a bit more, he's having these holdings that he might that he has in these illiquid investments. They might be investments in an entire company that's not listed, or part of a company that's not listed, or just shares that aren't traded very much, that he will find quite difficult to buy and sell. And he's been doing lots of things operationally to ease that, right?
Yes, and one of the things that he's been doing actually is moving assets between two different funds that he manages. One of these is a big open-ended fund, which means that assets can flow in and out, and he needs to manage that flow. Another fund is the Patient Capital Investment Trust. Now, as an investment trust, it's a closed fund, and that means that he doesn't need to manage the flows in and out. So you could argue that that is a much better vehicle for holding these unquoted assets. So one of the solutions that he's found is that he's moving unquoted shares from the open-ended fund into the closed-ended fund. But interesting, there's a limit to how much he can do that, because the closed-ended fund, the Patient Capital Investment Trust, can only increase the number of shares by a limited amount in any given year. In fact, just this week, he's gone back to shareholders and asked for permission to increase the amount of shares in order that he can buy some of the assets from the open-ended fund.
Yeah, and actually, the Patient Capital Trust that he launched... I'm going to guess 5 years ago, about the same time that he launched the firm with his name on it.
Yep.
The whole logic of launching an investment trust at that point was that he knew he was going to be holding small company shares and unquoted stocks, and that the closed-ended structure is better for that. You and I have spoken on the podcast before about that. If there's redemptions from a investment trust, I'm inverted commas redemptions, the share price simply falls. You don't necessarily have to do anything to the assets. It's different with an open-ended fund.
Yes, that's right. So if you are a shareholder in an investment trust and you no longer want to be a shareholder, you want to get your money back, then you sell your shares to another investor. That's different from the situation with an open-ended fund, where you can contact the fund manager and take your money out of the fund, and the fund manager is obliged to give you that money. That's the nature of open-ended funds. It's great for you as an investor. For the fund manager, it sometimes can create a bit of a headache, because if there are a lot of outflows, and this is the situation which Neil Woodford found himself in, it can be quite hard to manage.
And it echoes a little bit a situation that arose a few years ago with commercial property funds. Again, quite illiquid assets if you think about it, a big stake in an out-of-town shopping centre or a retail park or what have you. You can't just, you know, log on to an investment account and flog that. It takes a lot of work, probably a lot of cost, a lot of consultancy, a lot of middlemen, a lot of attritional activity. And in those cases, they had to take action, didn't they? In the open-ended commercial property funds, they had to put these things called dilution adjustments in. Effectively a penalising of people that wanted to leave the fund.
Yes, I mean, there is a very good argument that open-ended funds are a very unsuitable vehicle for holding big illiquid assets like commercial properties. And the reason being that, you know, if you hold, you know, 100,000 shares in BP, then you can sell 50 of them to meet a redemption need. If you own the Bluewater Shopping Centre, you can't sell one of the shops at the end of the shopping centre in order to meet a redemption. You know, there is that's the liquidity problem. And you're absolutely right. It was actually 3 years ago. It was just after the 2016 EU referendum when people got nervous about what Brexit might mean. They were cautious about holding UK assets, and that included UK commercial property. So they wanted to withdraw from these funds. And the managers of these open-ended property funds had a real problem then, because, you know, they were faced with the prospect of having to sell properties quickly, and the only way that they could sell a property quickly was by selling them at way below their fundamental value. So they were unwilling to do that, and because they were unwilling to do it, the only option left to them was to basically close the funds and say, sorry, you can't have any money, or if you really want to take some money out, then we're going to put a levy on you. We're going to charge you, you know, X percent to make it so unattractive to people that they just wouldn't do it.
Yeah, and the argument always in those cases was that extra cost to redeem in those circumstances reflected the costs of selling the extra cost. Maybe there's a little bit of fall in value there as well, but it's so that it doesn't simply fall only on the people that stay in the fund.
Well, exactly, and that's the principal reason for those kinds of levies, is to protect investors who are staying within the fund.
Yeah, which is not to say, of course, that you can't have some illiquid assets in open-ended funds. The normal way of it, I suppose, is that you'll have some redemptions on a certain day and some investments on a certain day, and you'll match them up wherever you can. But if there's flows in one in the redemption direction, that's when it becomes a problem. It's not so much of a problem if it's gradual and long term. You can sort of, you know, manage the portfolio in a way that releases enough cash.
And it's also not such a problem if you have a relatively small proportion of that fund in the illiquid assets, because you can always sell the liquid assets to deal with the redemptions and hold the illiquid assets for the long term. Of course, this is the problem which Neil Woodford faced, is that the fund has shrunk so much because of redemptions that it's become more difficult for him to do that.
Actually, it's kind of the sort of hidden work of a fund manager, or the less glamorous work of a fund manager, isn't it? We sort of assume it's all about, you know, let's have that stock instead of that stock. It's actually about managing flows in and flows out of a fund, and making sure there's enough cash and resource available.
Yeah, absolutely. And different funds have different requirements. So, for example, a fund which is held largely by small personal investors, you know, what the industry calls retail investors, probably has a lot more in and out flows than a big institutional fund, where the money arrives in big blocks and disappears in big blocks. So there's less day-to-day management required.
Okay, now, I said at the top that liquidity can be an issue for individuals, even if they only invest in large liquid blue chip shares. What do I mean by that? Well, if you need to raise money quickly for any reason, and you don't have enough free cash in your bank account or your savings account, you might have to sell investments. And if those investments have made losses at that point, you're going to have to lock in that loss, and you don't give them a chance to recover. So individuals can face a kind of liquidity risk as well.
Yes, I mean, you know, investment in the stock market in particular is a long-term thing. And, you know, people say, you shouldn't worry about the ups and downs of the market, because you know, if you're investing over a long period, the ups and downs will come out in the wash. That's absolutely true, but it's not true if suddenly you need the money. And that's why it's so important that you manage your finances in such a way that, you know, you separate the long-term investments, which you really won't want to touch at all until, you know, subsequently, you know, in 10, 20 years, whatever it is, you need to liquidate those investments. On the other side of your portfolio, you've got some ready cash to hand to meet your short-term spending needs. So, you know, if the boiler goes, or you need to buy a new car, you absolutely don't want to be forced to sell shares, because it might be the wrong moment in the market. The market might have fallen by 20%. And if you sell your shares at that point, you crystallize that loss. There's nothing you can do about it then. You can't get it back.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons why people who are saving into a defined contribution pension, and it always used to be the case that you'd hit a retirement date and it'd be very common to go buy an annuity. Not so common these days, but they're still part of the retirement scene. There would be this process of lifestyling in the years ahead of that moment. So you'd have maybe 10 years where you're gradually shifting from risk assets like equities to safer assets like bonds, and then shorter dated bonds as you get closer to retirement, to prevent that big moment and where it becomes a moment of risk.
And buy safer, it's interesting you should use the word safer, because by safer, what you mean is less volatile. So they move around less, so you're less likely to be caught out by a sudden dip in the price.
Yeah. And of course, we're talking about investments here, stock market and bond investments. The reality is, in people's personal finances, there's lots of other things that can be illiquid. Even, perhaps confusingly, something like a cash account. If it's a bond, if it's locking your money up for 5 years, and it will only let you get your money back in that time by losing all your interest. That's quite an illiquid thing. You can think it's all in cash, but you might not be able to get at it. But the real example, I suppose, or the more salient example, is property, where people are very sold on the investment case, rightly or wrongly, of retail or residential property, I should say. The risk they're probably underestimating is that what if you need that money at short notice? You're going to have to sell whatever the market in your area is doing, and that might mean you have to take a haircut on that money.
Yes, and we've all had experiences like this. Well, not maybe we haven't all have. I know that I certainly have. That I happened to move across the country to a new job around the time of the financial crisis. The property market fell. I found myself in a situation where I was selling a property at, you know, quite a lot less than it had been valued at a year earlier. Now, of course, in practice, it meant that, you know, I was then buying another property, which was also cheaper than it had been a year earlier. But, you know, I didn't have much control over that process. I had to move.
Yeah. OK, well, Tom, it's a technical issue, but I'm glad we talked about it because I think it's important and one for people to think about when they are making their own investments. That is all we have time for. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Ed.
You've been listening to the Money Talk podcast. Check fidelity.co.uk for daily written updates and articles on these and other topics from across Fidelity in the UK. And subscribe via iTunes to get the podcast downloaded direct to your devices every week. Please be aware that the value of investments and the income you get from them can go down as well as up, so you may not get back what you invest. This information doesn't constitute investment advice and should not be used as the basis for any investment decision, nor should it be treated as a recommendation for any investment. Eligibility to invest in an ISA or a pension and the value of tax savings depends on personal circumstances, and all tax rules may change. You will not normally be able to access money held in a pension until the age of 55. Reference to specific securities or funds should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell these securities or funds and is included for the purpose of illustration only. Fidelity Personal Investing does not give personal recommendations. If you're unsure about the suitability of an investment, you should speak to an authorised financial advisor.